and a warm welcome to Celebrating Success. Thank you for joining me. I'm Pauline Barclay, author of 9 published books. My passion is to write about events that happen in life and change everything for those involved, as well as those caught up in the maelstrom. I want my characters to sit at your side, steal your attention, and sweep you up into their story. Stories that will bring tears to your eyes, have you laughing out loud, and sometimes what they share with you will stay in your heart for a very long time. My books are available in Kindle or paperback and all available from Amazon. Today, my wonderful guest is an ex-police officer of 30 years. Today, he's a crime writer, Ian Walker, pen name John Mason, John J-O-N, has a wealth of knowledge that can make the hairs stand on the back of your neck. Ian joined the police force in the early 60s, where officers were issued with a truncheon and a whistle. Removable collars and the wearing of a tie was as important as discipline. Today, Ian talks about those early years in his career and how those days have formed an important part of his writing. So please sit back and enjoy meeting my wonderful guest. Hi, Ian. How lovely to meet you. And I know you're Ian Walker to me, but to all your readers, you're John Mason. You write police procedure, thriller-style books. But behind all of this, you're an ex-policeman yourself. And I'm assuming this is what really helps with all these wonderful stories you write.
It wasn't the first. So they obviously write about what you know. Although the trigger for my writing was reading 50 Shades of Grey. and I thought, yeah, I could do that. But it will never see the light of day unless it has major surgical reconstruction. And from that came 2 World War novels. None of those 3 have been finished. So I thought, write about what you know, but how can I make what I write different? Because you get senior detectives with more wool on their backs than merino sheep, junior detectives still with bags of experience, but nobody has ever written a police procedural about a police officer from the first day that he joined the police. And that was my starting point.
But let's go back to your starting point, Ian, John. I know you're Ian, but John is what the listeners will learn you know about you on their books. We're not talking about today, though, are we? We're talking about the early 1960s.
Yeah.
And things were very different in those days to what they are today, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there was no computer chips, no UHF radio. Modern science, modern technology, certainly forensic, well, modern technology didn't exist. And as far as that affects police investigations, if you're watching The Long Shadow, which is an expose or a biographical story of the Ripper inquiry. And I knew from a distance many of those senior officers. I met a lot of them because I worked in the area where they were at various times. But this is the time when policemen walked the beat. They carried a truncheon, which is a 12-inch piece of wood, which they kept in a pocket. They had a pair of handcuffs. But they lived on their wits. We had to make points, i.e. we had to go to a public telephone kiosk at a set time on the hour, or at different points on the hour, 5 minutes before and 5 minutes afterwards, so that if there was an incident they needed to attend or something needed to be told about, then you will get a phone call at the time. Also, it's where the sergeant should be able to find you at that time, 5 minutes before and 5 minutes afterwards. And between then, you patrolled your beat and you dealt with what came up.
But you were very much on your own, though, weren't you?
Oh, very much so. Yes, yes. There have been some hairy moments, but nothing untoward. Well, not too untoward. I'm still here to talk about it. But yeah, you were on your own. I worked at, if you read, Nemesis, which is the second novel, and Counting the Dead, which is the third novel, book 3 and 4 in the system. I refer to it as Westleigh. It's actually Cleckheaton, south of Bradford. And you patrolled your beat. You checked your property. If there are any vehicles out, any people out, you did the physical checks. And in those days, policemen didn't get... We weren't in the city, so we didn't have the high percentage of crime that they did in, say, Leeds or Bradford or Huddersfield or Wakefield. So it was safer, but there were no guarantees. You didn't know what was behind the next door or around the next corner.
So just in, for instance, going back to those days, Ian, you did have, perhaps you came across an incident on your beat. What would you have to do in those days to get help?
Well, we carried a whistle. If I'd known you were going to ask me these questions, I'd have had my truncheon and my handcuffs here, or a pair of handcuffs.
Pair of handcuffs. Sorry, readers, you can't see this. You can only hear this.
I sort of weren't mine, but that to go back to sort of 1850. That you to get help, you carried a whistle. You blew the whistle. If somebody heard it, they might ring in. You stop a passing vehicle. It never happened to me when I was in that situation whereby I couldn't get help.
Going back to what you've just said, Ian, you said you hope somebody would ring in. Now, people today assume ringing, pick the mobile phone up. That wasn't even heard of. And a lot of homes in those days didn't even have a landline.
Which is true. Yeah. So, but we also had, certainly in Cleckheaton, we had one officer who would be riding a motorbike. We had a lightweight motorcycle on night. For those of an age, it was a Velocet LE197cc. It was different in that it had a radiator to cool it down, and it was shaft driven, so it was quiet, so you could patrol the beach. So if you were lucky, they would turn up, or if you were on patrol, then you would have that. But that was a VHF radio. So that we did have VHF, but we only had VHF as far as that one vehicle was concerned. But you managed somehow. We might get people calling at the police station, said, "Oh, I've seen policeman so-and-so, it looks like he needs some help." Then you could get it, you could ring up for the traffic car to attend, or if the sergeant was available and in the office, he would turn out, take somebody with him. But you were very much on your own. I remember one night I was checking property. It was about turning out time for the pubs, and I checked this property and I could hear this noise on the Bradford Road. And I walked down there, and the road was blocked, totally blocked. People, about 40 or 50 people. And there'd been a bit of a scrap in the pub. And the licensee said, "If you're going to finish it outside, you're not messing my pub up." So they went outside for a fight in the road, and everybody followed. And I was thinking, what do I do? There's a telephone kiosk 50 yards away. And then somebody saw me and said, "Hey, coppers here." Well, I had the run. But no, in those days you could. So I sort of pushed me with. I was only 19, so I sort of eased my way through. But they kept me back long enough for these two in the middle to get out of the way. And when I got there, there was nothing. So there was no fight. So they weren't interested. So they went home.
But the interesting thing is, somebody saying, "As a copper here, even if you were only just 19, that was enough to scare them.
They didn't want any trouble. They just wanted to square the differences. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it was. There was a bit more respect for the uniform than there is these days.
And of course, in those days, your uniform was quite significant. There was a lot of it. As you had the helmet, you had the button jackets. Unlike the officers today, it's almost like a little tunic by comparison.
Yes, it was. We had summer uniforms and winter uniforms as well.
Because you had collar and tie in those days as well.
But they were collar detached. So you had the stud pressing into your Adam's apple, which was, but yes, collar detached, and we had capes.
Did you?
And we had, oh yes, capes and greatcoats and raincoats, and yeah, they were warm. They were warm. I've known a policeman walk around with a pint of beer under his cape, talking to the inspector. And when the inspector left, he says, "You can finish your beer now, lad." So. But he knew all the time. It's
So
another thing.
these wonderful memories takes, and I know a lot of my listeners will be able to relate to that time. And the book I'm reading is The Blooding of Brian Blake. And of course, that's set in those early times you've just mentioned. And can I assume that some of the information in the book is taken from all your experience?
A lot of it is autobiographical. Not the hero piece, I hasten to add, but Panlash actually existed. It's now derelict, which is quite sad because it's an
And
18th century. Panlash.
panel
Panlash.
ash.
Yeah.
That was the training school for you young officers, wasn't
Yeah, number three district police training centre just south of Harrogate. Everything I described there about the grounds, about the buildings and the layout. I actually put the protagonist, Brian Blake, into the same bed that I used. There's nothing homoerotic about it, but I followed him into that bed 2 years later, exactly the same. So anything to do with, there's a piece on there where they arrive, he and his friend John arrived back late, having been to John's house in Harrogate, and they have to climb in through the back window. That was right next to my bed.
So it is very much based on your experience of those days.
Anything to do with Panlash is as I remember it, which is to see it now is quite sad. It's an 18th
It must
century.
because the way you described it in your book, it sounded like a beautiful, I suppose, manor house is
It
one of the
was.
things. I love the little bit about the swimming pool heated. You said indoor heated swimming pool. I like how you said it was definitely indoors. But as for heated, you weren't sure.
Well, the ice had melted. Yeah. You knew if the ice
Exactly.
had melted, you know the heating was on.
Yes. So that book is very much set in those early days. How long are you in the police force for?
Short of 30 years.
30 years. So you saw some huge changes from those early 60s, well into the 90s.
Yeah, 1990, 1st of March 1993, I retired. But so it's, yeah, that's.
And does that experience over those 30 years, does that come in the other books in the series? Or is it going to stay mainly in the 60s?
No, I shall take it through. My career went down a trend that most people wouldn't. I left training school. I was late going to training school because I got appendicitis. So I had to take, I instead of going in March, I went in September. And then I came out, I went to Cleckheaton. From there, I went to Bradford. To Wakefield, I went on road traffic. I was one of those nice traffic policemen.
Oh, gosh, can people remember the traffic policeman?
Or
You
the
wouldn't.
nice one, yeah. We weren't, unless you had some reason to keep out of our way. I did 2 years in the force control room. That's where I learned radar operating skills, and that was all VHF. And the motorway, we were just getting the very very early motorway signals, which had the two or the amber flashing lights at the side of the road, which could be switched on by an aircraft flying over, so it created havoc. From there, I was promoted, went to Bradford to Western Area Control, just as they were setting up the Embryo computer unit. And because I got experience in traffic and communications, no knowledge of computers at all, I was seconded. There was an inspector and four sergeants, and we worked with Ferranti. Ferranti were under contract to the government to set up this what they call command and control system, which was nothing to do with Big Brother. It was this recording of incidents and resource deployment. And then, of course, at the back of it, once it's there, that you can analyze what there is. And it proved to be so useful in the first phase in Birmingham that it was spread around the country. It went to second phase was Strathclyde. Third phase was Stafford. We were the last developmental phase. And then we set up the communications training wing, and I was there until I was sent to Holbeck. Because they said, you want to go, pick where you want, we'll send you. So I said, well, anyway, only Holbeck, because nobody wanted to go to Holbeck. So, of course, I was posted to Holbeck. And that was the first time I'd worked in a city division. And I did 3 years as patrol sergeant, 3 years as a custody officer, and the last 4 years as the station sergeant. So the biggest problem there was my office was between the front office and the radio room. That was my area of expertise. And then next door was the superintendent's office, and he knew where I was. So if you want anything doing, I got that as well. But that was.
But that's so in that 30 years, Ian, you must have seen some huge changes in how information's gathered and how you are able to catch the criminals a little bit, hopefully, easier than they were back in the 60s when, as you said, there wasn't the forensics that there is in the 90s and certainly today.
The changes in computers were just coming in. Mobile phones were just coming in the 90s. Most people didn't have one. They were huge, though, like the size of a house brick. If you put one in your handbag, you'd find out the strap would break. But we were getting better radios. We were getting the police national computer was online. That came online in the 70s. And the beauty of it is it covered the whole of the country. And initially it recorded just lost and stolen vehicles, and then it was expanded. I don't know how much it does now. I haven't seen it for a long, long time. But there's a link to Swansea, to the driving and vehicle licensing centre, so we could find out who the recorded keeper of a vehicle was. So we could get that information. But it still worked. It still boils down to the Mark One human brain. No matter what you've got as computers, it's the people that are using it and the policeman on the beat or detective or whatever they're doing. And it all goes on. It's all about what goes on between their ears.
Right.
That we haven't evolved any more than we were 2,000 years ago. We just have more technology. But it's that ability to, and the desire to get the job done and to think. So the technologies help, but it's not the answer.
Right.
It gives us answers, it gives us information, but it's the human being that has to make the decisions. You can't rely on the computer. The computer won't come up and say, "Go and arrest so and so." It will give you certain information, but then it has to be assessed and dealt with by the officers or by whoever tells you what to do. So, but yeah, it's a great help. Just to drift back to the Ripper, they didn't have a system called HOLMES, HOLMES, which is the Home Office Large something inquiry system, which could analyse the information. Because if you've seen the pictures on the Ripper inquiry or the carousels, literally with hundreds of thousands of index cards in, and it only takes somebody to be distracted and to write the wrong thing or to put it in the wrong place, and a vital piece of information might be lost. And I'm fairly certain that was, it wasn't there. But then once they got the Holmes system where it could be put on a computer, the computer doesn't forget. The computer can analyze what it has, and that's made the job far easier. The information was probably there beforehand, but you
But the
think that.
access to that information was probably very different to what it is today,
Oh,
and even in the
absolutely.
days when you did.
Yeah.
Now, Ian, I know you've got lots of lovely stories you want to share with me, and I want to share them with our listeners. We're going to run out of time today. So what I would like to say is, will you come back? And I know you've given me a list of some of the ideas you want to talk about. I'm not going to give them all away, but believe you me, listeners, they're worth listening to. So will you come back and talk about those on another episode?
As you wish, yeah, anytime you want.
I definitely wish. In the meantime, listeners, if you want to know a little bit more about Ian and his writing, he writes under John Mason, and John being JON. His latest book, The Blooding of Brian Lake, is available in paperback and Kindle, and you can get it on Amazon or in your shop. And it is set in the early 60s, in the early days when Ian was a young officer. It's a brilliant book. I'm actually 40% into reading it and loving every page. So if you want to learn a little bit more about those early days in policing and the adventures Ian went through, read the book. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to me. We will talk again. I really want to go through some of those gory stories you've been threatening to tell me, and I'd like to share them with our listeners.
You're welcome.
So I'm just going to say bye for now, and I'll see you very, very soon to talk more.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to talking again. Take care and catch up with you very soon. Thank you, Ian. It's been fascinating hearing about those days when a police officer was on the beat. Listeners, if you enjoyed hearing about those early years of a policeman's life, then take a look at Ian's book. It is fiction, but has many parallels to Ian's years as a young officer. The Blooding of Bryan Lake by John Mason, which is set in the early 1960s and is available in Kindle and paperback. You can find out more about Ian on his website, johnmasonbooks.com. Remember, John is spelt J-O-N. As always, a huge thank you for joining me, and I can't wait to share your company again very soon. And of course, you can listen to all my podcasts at paulinebarclay.podbean.com or on Spotify. As with all my podcasts, you are more than welcome to share them with your family and friends. I do hope you will. And finally, don't forget you can find out more about me on my website, paulinebarclay.co.uk. Until we meet again, I hope the sun is shining on your face and in your heart. See you soon. Ta-ta for now.